Module 2 is interpersonal communication. This covers chapter 2 in the textbook, so let's go ahead and get out our study sheet. And as you can see, we're going to talk about different elements of communication. We'll talk about some schools of counseling and some effective ways that planners can communicate with their clients. We'll also talk a little bit about behavioral finance and various biases that we see with respect to investing and financial planning. We'll start off, though, by talking about schools of counseling. We'll go through planner-client communication tips and best practices, behavioral finance theory, cognitive and emotional biases, and we'll wrap up this module by talking about risk and loss aversion. Let's start off, though, by talking about schools of counseling. There are three main approaches to counseling, and this does not just apply to financial planning. This is just in general. Of course, we're going to talk about how these do apply to financial planning, but those three main approaches to counseling are the developmental approach, the humanistic approach, and the cognitive behavioral approach. And you need to know the difference between these. You'll probably get one or two questions on this on your exam. We'll start off by talking about the developmental approach. The developmental approach is based on the theory that human development occurs in predictable stages. This was influenced by Freud, and it suggests that disruptions in normal development result in predictable problems, symptoms, and behaviors. This could apply to any area of mental wellness, but with respect to financial planning, an example could be, let's say that I have a wealthy client, someone who is wealthy now, but growing up, they had no money. Their family was in poverty. They lived in poverty. Based on the fact that they are wealthy now and they grew up in an environment of poverty, that client may exhibit behaviors even now that are consistent with those that were exhibited when that person was growing up. For example, if they grew up in poverty, but they're wealthy now, they may still save 85-90% of their income and live as though they're paycheck to paycheck. And the reason for that is because when they were growing up, as they were developing, they had an environment where they were living in poverty. So even though right now the client's financially sound, they're misapplying these scripts that were useful back when they were a child. This particular approach attempts to correct earlier disrupted development to foster change in the client's behavior. The second school of counseling is the humanistic approach, and this is based on philosophical theory. Humanistic counselors define proper mental health as having congruent and aligned thoughts and behaviors, and the treatment goals are centered on self-reflection. This is a very optimistic theory. Instead of concentrating on what is wrong with people, the humanistic approach is more focused on helping them overcome their difficulties through personal growth. It focuses on a client's mental health, personal responsibility, and freedom of choice, and there are several types of therapy that are used by the counselors under the humanistic approach, and they're all designed to support people as they work toward change. And the final approach is the cognitive behavioral approach. This approach focuses on identifying aspects of one's surroundings that are unhealthy and could be changed. It was initially based on animal research, and you may need to know that for your exam, but it evaluates the effectiveness of environmental reinforcers when treating problematic behaviors and self-talk. Let's say I'm a financial planner and I create a curriculum for my clients. In other words, they have certain homework assignments, things that they need to do each month to work toward their goals. And so what I might do in this situation is just keep up with their progress. And if they get behind, what I do is turn my focus to diagnosing the factors that are causing them to get behind. That's the cognitive behavioral approach. So let's do a practice question. The idea that treatment goals are centered on the acceptance of personal responsibility, recognizing freedom of choice, and focusing on the present moment follows which school of thought? And we have the developmental school, the humanistic school, the cognitive behavioral school and then a made-up one, the traditional school of thought. And if you remember what we just said a second ago, the humanistic school of thought has the one where treatment goals are centered on self-reflection, and so B is our answer. Let's discuss planner-client communication. Financial planning involves many quantitative and technical processes. For example, when it comes to financial planning, we may be doing a calculation of how much somebody needs to save to fund their retirement or to fund an education savings plan or whether or not they need to reduce their expenses. We may go through a huge quantitative analysis where we're crunching a lot of numbers. But being able to effectively communicate is equally as important. It's important that not only does a financial planner understand these results and be able to determine the results and calculate these different results, the financial planner has to be able to effectively communicate those results to clients so the client can understand the results, feel comfortable with these results, and be ready to take on some action. There are several elements of effective communication. We're going to talk about each of these individually, and what we'll go through is active listening versus passive listening. We'll discuss different learning styles of clients, establishing trust, nonverbal communication, and asking different types of questions, open-ended questions, closed questions. We'll go through that as well. Let's start by talking about active versus passive listening. The ability to listen is the biggest skill required to be a successful financial advisor. Active listening requires undivided attention and dedicated concentration, but it doesn't just involve sitting there and listening to your client talk. There's a lot more that goes into active listening. Sitting there and listening to the client talk, that's actually passive listening, which we'll talk about in just a second. When practicing active listening, one must put aside irrelevant thoughts, observe body language, and paraphrase what the speaker is saying, and ask follow-up questions. It's really participating in the conversation. That's what active listening is all about. A follow-up question, for example, could be, "And then what did you say?" to keep the client talking. Rephrasing statements include items such as, "Let me see if I understand this correctly." That's active listening. It's very important when meeting with clients to practice active listening. Passive listening requires very little of the listener. Passive listening occurs during seminars, educational settings, social gatherings, and sermons where the listener is mostly just sitting there and listening to what the speaker is saying. The communication rests entirely on the speaker with respect to passive listening. When communicating with the client, it's also important to understand the client's learning style. There are two main learning styles. One is visual learning, and the other is verbal or auditory learning. And clients usually have a preferred style. For example, I prefer visual learning to verbal or auditory learning. Planners should adapt their communication to each client's needs, and understanding the client's preferred learning style can help the planner develop an effective communication plan. I mentioned before that my preferred learning style is visual learning, and it seems as though the majority of individuals prefer that style because visual learners make up 65% of the population. Visual learners respond well to charts and graphics. In fact, in the next module, we're going to discuss various approaches to financial planning. One such approach is the pie chart approach, where we're showing reports to the clients by the use of pie charts. That would be effective for a visual learner. Verbal auditory learners focus their attention on every spoken word. They ask for an explanation of words, and they learn better when images include phrases and annotations. Those are the two learning styles. It's important to understand the difference. Establishing trust is also critical when communicating with the client. Establishing trust allows the advisor to strengthen their relationship and build rapport with their clients. It can be difficult to establish trust, but it's very, very important. Trust is established with empathy, respecting client wishes, and exhibiting discretion. For example, one good way to establish trust is saying something like, "I've had other clients struggle with this particular issue." That's a good way to establish trust. A bad way to establish trust is to show a lack of discretion, saying something like, "Let me just pull up Scott and Stacy's analysis and show you exactly what I mean." In other words, pulling up an analysis for a different client, that's not a good way to establish trust. Trust can be damaged if the advisor does not maintain confidentiality of clients and lacks empathy. Clients may also use nonverbal cues to communicate. That includes body language, facial expressions, and voice tone or pitch. Nonverbal cues can sometimes convey more information than the words that are spoken. So as a planner, you need to be able to read the nonverbal cues in addition to listening to what the client is saying. Being able to accurately read facial expressions can lead to more effective communications with clients. And also, it's important to understand the different types of questions and to use the questions appropriately. There are two main types of questions you need to be familiar with, and one of them is open-ended questions, and those are keys to learning about clients' goals. There's also the closed questions, and those can pinpoint specific information. Both of these questions are useful, although open-ended questions are probably a little more useful. Open-ended questions are a simple strategy to collect data, but it may put the client in a defensive position. An example of an open-ended question is, "Why do you like working with that planner?" It's going to cause the client to answer the question in a descriptive way, not just a yes or no answer. The problem, though, is if I ask a client, "Why do you like working with that planner?" they may feel as though they have to defend themselves. "I like that planner because they're a friend of mine," or "they feel like they do good work. Why are you asking me that?" So you have to be careful with open-ended questions to not make the client feel defensive. But the great thing about these open-ended questions is they do cause the client to provide a descriptive answer that isn't just yes or no. Another good example of an open-ended question is, "What is your opinion about a certain topic or something? What is your opinion about the stock market? What is your opinion about the new tax law?" That can cause the client to provide a descriptive answer. And what you might want to do when you're asking open-ended questions, such as a why question or a what question, give the clients time to answer. It's okay if there's silence for some period of time. You want to let them answer the question. And of course, you definitely want to ask follow-up questions if clarification is needed. Closed-end questions are also useful as well. But sometimes there are only limited responses that are available. That could be, for example, a yes-no question or a true-false question, where there's really just one-word answers or just two-word answers. Does, how, and when, like when did you get married, that's going to result in maybe a one-word answer or one-phrase answer. How much income do you receive from your farm? That's a closed question. Does this implementation schedule look okay to you? That's a closed question. Closed questions require a specific response, but they do have some purpose in the communication process. So let's do a couple of practice questions. Which of the following statements is correct regarding planner-client communication? Advisors should passively listen to their clients throughout their meetings. It's important in a client meeting to engage in active listening, so A is false. What about B? Advisors should use both open and closed questions during their client meetings. Absolutely, both types of questions serve a purpose, so B is our answer. C, advisors should avoid using phrases that demonstrate empathy when building trust with their client. No, empathy is one of the most important ways to build trust, so you don't want to avoid empathy. You want to display empathy, so C is false. And D, advisors should only pay attention to the words their clients are using and ignore all other nonverbal cues. Nonverbal cues may even be more important than the verbal message that the client is relaying to you. So D is false, B is our answer. Which of the following is most likely the beginning of an open-ended question? And we have, is it not true that, would, do, or how? And the answer is how. How do you feel about whatever? That is an example of an open-ended question. So we often see open-ended questions begin with the word how, so D is our answer. Let's talk a little bit about behavioral finance theory. And before we actually get into behavioral finance theory, let's spend a little bit of time talking about traditional finance theory, because behavioral finance theory is relatively new, certainly when compared to traditional finance theory. Traditional finance theory, which is also known as modern portfolio theory, is based on several different elements. And the first element of traditional finance is that investors are perfectly rational, whereas behavioral finance assumes that they're not necessarily going to always be rational. Another element of traditional finance is that markets are efficient. And what that means is that there's no way for one individual to consistently outperform the market. So, for example, if you want to buy some stock, you might do some research, but the idea under an efficient market is that everybody else also has access to that same research, so you're not going to be able to outperform all the other investors. You're not going to be able to outperform the market as a whole. Traditional finance assumes that markets are efficient, which means everybody has the same information, and it's really impossible to beat the market consistently. In addition, traditional finance theory is based on mean variance portfolio theory and the capital asset pricing model. And what those say is that an investor's return should be commensurate with the amount of risk they're taking on. In other words, the more risk you take on, the higher your return should be. Those are principles of traditional finance. And also, it's based on the idea that beta, which is a measure of risk, can be used to judge the volatility of an investment. Let's take a look at each of these elements. And the first one is rational investors. Traditional finance is based on rational investors. In other words, investors are expected to identify appropriate investments without emotion and fund them optimally. That's not, of course, always the case. In fact, it usually isn't the case. And that's why behavioral finance indicates that investors are not always rational, but traditional finance has the assumption that investors are rational. Rational investors would avoid guaranteed payouts and take on more risk if it will result in additional returns. Rational investors would, without passion, sell investments that have lost value to claim tax deductions. That's what traditional finance says. That's what rational investors do. But a lot of people hold on to investments that have lost money, thinking someday it's going to come back. And of course, rational investors would also avoid panic selling. But as we know, people are not always rational. In addition, traditional finance is based on efficient markets. In other words, assets are priced appropriately based on currently available information, and everybody has access to that currently available information. And assets will also adjust predictably and reasonably to new information. So in other words, an investor like you or me cannot consistently outperform the market if the market is efficient. So the U.S. stock market is thought to be efficient, and therefore it's considered to be impossible for you or me to consistently outperform the market performance. Mean variance portfolio theory is also an element of traditional finance. That considers investments based on risk and expected return. Variance is a measure of risk. The higher the variance, the higher the risk, and therefore the higher the return an investor should receive. The more risk you take on, the higher the return you should receive. That's a main principle of traditional finance. Investors should specify either their required rate of return or their preferred level of risk. and the portfolio should then be selected that fits their specifications. And finally, we have beta. Beta is a measure of risk, and specifically, it's a measure of market risk. It's not a measure of all risk that exists, but it's a measure of market risk only. The market itself, which is often considered to be the S&P 500, the market has a beta of 1. So the S&P 500 has a beta of 1, and if you purchase an individual stock, let's say of ABC Company, and that individual stock has a beta greater than 1, that means that your stock is more risky than the overall market, because the overall market has a beta of 1. Of course, if your stock has a beta of less than 1, let's say 0.8, that means that your stock is less risky than the overall market itself. Investments with a beta exceeding 1 are more volatile than the market, more risky than the market. And of course, investments with a beta of less than 1 are less volatile than the market. Beta can be used to calculate an expected rate of return under the capital asset pricing model. The capital asset pricing model calculation is actually beyond the scope of this particular course. That's something you would do in the investments course, but not in this particular course. But nonetheless, we can use beta to help us determine what our return on an investment should be under the capital asset pricing model. And beta can also be used to create a diversified portfolio with a known level of risk. Now that we've discussed some of the principles of traditional finance, let's turn our attention to behavioral finance theory. Behavioral finance is relatively new. It does not fully reject traditional finance theory. It just alters some of the assumptions. Behavioral finance theory assumes that investors are sometimes irrational, which I believe is correct. Markets are not always efficient. Sometimes markets are inefficient under behavioral finance theory. Behavioral portfolio theory governs, and risk alone does not determine returns. Those are some concepts associated with behavioral finance. So let's do a practice question. In accordance with the principles of traditional finance, in other words, modern portfolio theory, traditional finance, a rational investor is affected by bias and emotion. Under behavioral finance, yes, but not under traditional finance. Under traditional finance, investors are rational, so A is false. B, markets are inefficient. They sometimes are inefficient in accordance with behavioral finance theory, but not in accordance with traditional finance. Traditional finance says that markets are efficient, so B is false. C, investment return is commensurate with the risk undertaken by the investor. That is a correct statement. Under traditional finance, the more risk you take on, the higher the return you should receive. So C is our answer. And D, mean variance portfolio theory should be ignored as it produces unreliable results over a long-term time horizon. That's false. We do look at mean variance portfolio theory and the capital asset pricing model under traditional finance. So once again, C is our answer. Let's continue our discussion of behavioral finance by talking about cognitive and emotional biases. These cognitive and emotional biases have been investigated by behavioral finance researchers, and what they've determined with their investigation, with their research, is that traditional finance alone is insufficient for understanding the various markets and investor behavior. These biases play into decision making, and they play into the performance and reaction of the markets. There are two types of biases. There are cognitive biases, which involve decision making based on established concepts that may or may not be accurate. And there are emotional biases, which are generally spontaneous, and they're based on personal feelings. The cognitive biases include anchoring, confirmation bias, hindsight bias, overreaction, and representativeness. We're going to go through each one of those, and we'll also go through the two emotional biases, which are herding and overconfidence. Let's start by talking about the cognitive biases. The first one is anchoring. Anchoring is a type of cognitive bias, and it's the act of attaching one's thoughts to a reference point. It's also known as conservatism or perseverance. It's common when decisions are being made that are novel or new to the decision maker. For example, if I ask someone, does 8% feel like a good rate of return on investment to you? Their answer would depend on what happened maybe last year. For example, if they had a rate of return last year of negative 10%, then yes, an 8% rate of return this year would seem great. However, if last year they had a rate of return of 25%, well then this year, the rate of return of only 8% would not seem like a good rate of return. This anchoring bias can be mitigated by finding objective measures of value. Another cognitive bias is confirmation bias. People tend to filter information and focus on information supporting their opinions. For example, let's say that I believe that the stock market's about to crash. What I'd probably do is do a search on YouTube or on Google or something like that, looking for investment advisors that also agree with me. I could do a search on YouTube and find a lot of investment advisor videos where they're indicating that they think an 80% stock market crash is imminent. But of course, I could also find on YouTube a bunch of investment advisors that feel like the market's going to double over the next year or two. Confirmation bias would be where I'm seeking out the people that tend to agree with me, agree with my perception, my opinion. This confirmation bias can be mitigated by actively seeking disconfirming evidence and surrounding oneself with diverse viewpoints. A third type of cognitive bias is hindsight bias. That's the feeling of knowing all along what would happen. It may lull the investor into believing they can perform better or more efficiently. I've talked to several people that back after the 2008 stock market crash, I talked to them. They told me, oh yeah, back in 2008, I saw that coming from a mile away. I knew all along that was going to happen. Yet a lot of them did not reallocate any of their investments into cash or safer investments prior to the crash. Hindsight bias can be mitigated by keeping records and making small test runs of ideas before overcommitting. Overreaction is another type of cognitive bias. It's a larger than is warranted reaction to news or the overweighting of sample information. Let's say that a pharmaceutical company just had a new drug that failed the clinical trials, so an investor just immediately sells all of their stock in the pharmaceutical company. That's an overreaction. This overreaction bias can be mitigated by taking a pause and maybe sleeping on it before acting and seeking objective advice. And then finally, we have representativeness. That's also a type of cognitive bias. That's where individuals determine the probability of an occurrence based on its apparent relationship with an event existing in their mind. Sometimes it's a tendency to look at two things thinking that they have something in common or some relationship when really there is no such relationship. For example, let's say that I'm looking at a stock and over the last 6 months, the stock has tripled in value. So I'm thinking naturally that means the stock's going to triple in value again over the next 6 months. That's representativeness. I'm trying to equate two events that really probably are not related in any way, shape, or form. Past performance does not predict future results is a warning to investors against representativeness. It's when people think that two similar things are closely correlated to each other when that may not be the case. Representativeness can be mitigated by conducting fundamental analysis on the investment. Fundamental analysis involves looking at a company's financial statements, doing ratio analysis, which we'll talk about later in this course, to determine what the value of the investment is. So instead of looking at past performance over the last 6 months or 1 year or 2 years and trying to determine future performance based on that, what I should do instead is do some type of fundamental analysis. So those were the types of cognitive biases. We also have two emotional biases, and the first one is herding. That stems from people's desire to conform or be accepted by a certain group. For example, maybe you're at a party and you hear a bunch of people talking about cryptocurrency, so you decide to follow along and invest in cryptocurrency yourself. That's the herd mentality. That's herding. This can be mitigated by looking for objective measures of value. And our last emotional bias is overconfidence. That occurs when an investor overweights their own skills or research capabilities. Overconfident investors trade more than their less confident peers. That's important to know for your exam. Someone who's overconfident is going to place more trades in general. Can be mitigated by recalling failures, seeking objective measures, and keeping performance records. Someone might indicate, if they're overconfident, they might indicate that they don't need a financial planner because they do their own research. That could be a sign of overconfidence. We mentioned earlier that behavioral finance is relatively new, and it's certainly new compared to traditional finance. But actually, behavioral finance essentially began back in the 70s, back in 1979, with prospect theory. Prospect theory is commonly regarded as the first major theory of behavioral finance, and prospect theory suggests that people value gains differently from losses and will base decisions on perceived gains rather than perceived losses. For example, if I'm a financial planner and I go to you as a client and I say to you, if you invest in this particular stock, there's an 80% chance you will have a gain, you're probably going to react much more favorably to me saying that than if I came to you and said there's a 20% chance that you would have a loss. That's involving prospect theory. That has to do with prospect theory. Prospect theory has many different components, but one critical piece of prospect theory is framing. The way that the planner frames the scenario, frames the question, that can influence the decision. Investment decisions can be influenced by how the decision is framed. Once again, back to my example, we'll use slightly different percentages, but considering a 75 or 80% chance of gain is more attractive than considering a 25% or 20% chance of loss. So the way the scenario is framed can influence the decision. Framing does affect risk tolerance. Clients are likely to react differently and be more or less aggressive depending on if they're trying to protect gains versus recover losses. For example, somebody who's trying to recover losses might be more aggressive when it comes to investing than someone who's trying to protect their gains. Planners can nudge their clients by choosing the proper framing. For example, if I have a 65-year-old client whose portfolio exists entirely of cash, which has a very, very low return. Let's say they have a $2 million portfolio and they've invested that all in cash in money market accounts. Their rate of return is close to zero. What I could do is point out their future real dollar losses to inflation to try and nudge them into a more aggressive portfolio. Remember, recovering losses can cause someone to be willing to be more aggressive. And I can use framing to nudge my clients. Disposition effect describes the behavior of investors who sell assets when prices rise and hold assets when prices fall. This really isn't the best strategy. A lot of people do this. When assets start increasing in value, sell them, take your gains before it falls. When assets fall, some people hold on to them, hoping that they'll recover their losses in the future. The asset will have a comeback. The reality is, though, a rational investor would look at the entire return of the portfolio and not just hold on to the losers and get rid of the winners. Someone affected by disposition effect holds on to losers to avoid the pain of realizing a loss. This can be mitigated by reframing the situation. For example, we can point out to a client that sometimes it would be beneficial to sell a stock that has lost value because that could offset the capital gains tax on assets that we've sold that have increased in value. So I have clients that have capital gains, and in December, we'll sometimes look at their portfolio and look at some of their investments that have lost money and go ahead and sell those losers at the end of the year just to offset those capital gains from a tax standpoint. So let's do a couple of practice questions. Which of the following statements is or are correct regarding the overconfidence bias? One, it leads investors to reduce trading frequency because they are more confident of their investment decisions. We said before, people that are overconfident tend to trade more, so one is false. They don't trade less, they trade more. It is a type of cognitive bias. Now, the overconfidence bias is a type of emotional bias, so neither one of these two statements are correct. Which one of the following is an example of the disposition effect? An investor purchases stock for $100 but refuses to sell it when it drops to $90 because they believe the stock should be valued at $105. Well, that actually is an example of disposition effect. A is correct. If we have someone who is reluctant to sell an investment because it's gone down in value, that is an example of disposition effect. So A is our answer. Let's wrap up module 2 by talking about risk and loss aversion. If you remember earlier, we were talking about traditional finance, and one of the elements of traditional finance was the capital asset pricing model, or CAPM. CAPM predicts the expected return of an investment based on beta. And if you remember from earlier, we talked about beta as well, and we said beta is a measure of the risk of the overall market. For example, the risk of the S&P 500. And what CAPM says is that if an investor purchases an investment that is more risky than the overall market itself, that investment should have a rate of return that's higher than the rate of the return of the market. So let's say that you purchase stock of a company with a beta of 1.1, which, remember, beta of 1 is the beta of the market. So if you purchase a stock with a beta of 1.1, that's going to have more risk than the market itself. So if the S&P 500, which is the market, returns 10%, your investment, since it has a higher beta than 1, should have a higher rate of return. So let's say that you invest in a stock, it's got a beta of 1.1, and the market itself returns 10% for the year, you should expect your return to be roughly 11% on your investment because you took on more risk than the market, so you should have a higher return than the market. The CAPM model uses the market risk, or beta, as the baseline. Investors elect to take on more risk and expect to receive more return, or they take on less risk, in which case they'd expect to receive a lower return than the market. So if your beta of your investment was less than 1 and the market returned 10%, you would expect to get a return of less than 10% because you have less risk. That's the capital asset pricing model. That's part of traditional finance. The behavioral asset pricing model is a product of behavioral finance, and it also predicts returns based on market risk, but also it includes the following. It includes market capitalization ratios, stock momentum is factored into return, social responsibility factors, and even investor emotions. Remember, under traditional finance, we assume that investors are rational. Under behavioral finance, we don't assume that they're rational. Emotions come into play. Economic models are based on reason, but emotions drive investors to make decisions that aren't consistent with these economic models. So the behavioral asset pricing model does attempt to predict return, but it also includes a lot of additional factors such as emotion and social responsibility factors that we don't see considered with traditional finance. A couple of additional concepts you need to know for your exam are risk capacity and risk tolerance. You need to know the difference between those two terms. Risk capacity is the amount of risk an investor can take on. How much risk can you take on? It's influenced by your cash flow, assets and liabilities, human capital, the number of dependents you have. So it represents the amount of risk that you could theoretically accept. People with higher risk capacity tend to have higher income, fewer expenses, less debt. Let's say that I'm relatively young, just started working, my income's relatively low, I've got a lot of expenses, I just bought a house, so I have a lot of debt. I don't have the ability to take on any more risk. I don't have any risk capacity left. And if I did, it's probably very little. So risk capacity is the amount of risk that someone could theoretically accept. Risk tolerance is the amount of risk an individual is actually willing to accept. Risk capacity and risk tolerance are not the same thing. Risk tolerance is influenced by emotions, knowledge, attitudes, and general propensity for risky behavior. People with higher risk tolerance tend to have less stable income, shorter work history, riskier investments. In my example, my real example, I'm not young anymore. I'm older. I'm getting close to retirement age. And so I don't have a lot of debt. Income's pretty decent. And so I do theoretically have a pretty high risk capacity, but I'm a very conservative investor. My risk tolerance is a lot lower than my risk capacity. Just because a client has a high capacity for risk doesn't mean they necessarily have a high risk tolerance. So let's do a practice question. The behavioral asset pricing model considers all the following risk factors when predicting investment returns, except market capitalization ratios, investor emotions, social responsibility factors, and inflation rates. And we mentioned before that there are additional factors that are considered under the behavioral asset pricing model when determining return, and that includes market capitalization ratios, investor emotions, social responsibility factors. It includes market risk as well, and even stock momentum. But one thing that we did not mention that is not part of the behavioral asset pricing model is inflation rates. So D is our answer, and that concludes Module 2.